By the beginning of 1863, British public opinion had begun to sway in favor of the North, largely as a result of Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, which presented the Civil War as a war of liberation of the American Negro slaves. This, plus Northern Democratic pressure, seems to have moved the British to honor their commitment not to build warships for the Confederate Navy. After the escape of the Alabama, Secretary of State William Seward said that the British government's policy could lead to war with the United States if they did not start seizing ships clearly intended for the Confederacy. The Alexander was the third major ship against which Dudley took action. He had been gathering evidence against it since the fall of 1862, and by the time he passed his findings into the Collector of Customs in March 1863, Dudley knew that Bullock had the contract for the Alexander's construction, and he could trace its ownership back to Fraser, Trenholme, and Company, the secret owners of many of these British-built Confederate ships. Dudley's spies had also collected testimonies from shipyard workers regarding the Alexandra's true destination. As with the previous ships, Dudley's evidence was passed around various departments of the British government. This time, however, it was decided that Dudley was correct about the Alexandra, and it was seized on 5 April 1863, just as it was about to depart. This was an incredible victory for the North. Now the British had enforced the Foreign Enlistment Act, they could be made to do so again. A similar strategy of combining espionage to collect information for use in the British courts was used to halt the sale of two additional ironclad ships to the Confederacy, the so-called Laird Rams. The seizure of the Laird Rams by the British government signaled the ultimate victory of Thomas Dudley over James Bullock, and by extension, the North over the South. The British had been forced into upholding the Foreign Enlistment Act, which made it possible for the Confederacy to build more warships in British shipyards. Although several smaller vessels escaped Britain during the remainder of the war, Dudley continued to improve his intelligence network and gather information on Confederate activities. The New Jersey lawyer's accomplishments can perhaps best be summed up by a British description of him as the American consul at Liverpool, whose activity in hunting for secret information appears to have been indefatigable. The lawyer from New Jersey had beaten his opponent to win a crucial part of the war for his country, equal to that part of the best Union generals in the field. As we have already seen, after Pulaski's dismissal in January 1862, Sanford was ordered by Seward to focus his attention exclusively toward thwarting Confederates on the continent, where he had begun operations soon after his initial arrival in Belgium months before. In Paris, Seward worked closely with a New York newspaper man and counsel, John Bigelow. Seward also relied heavily on wealthy New York businessman and socialite Nelson Beckwith. Together, the three men ran northern surveillance operations in Europe for 2.5 years. As Beckwith argued, secrecy was crucial. Keep to verbals and in a position to know nothing about it in case of need. You cannot trust any of these people with a line in writing. Sanford relied on more extensive networks as well. Shortly after his arrival in Belgium in April 1861, Sanford established reliable communications with northern agents in various coastal ports that Confederates were willing to use to ship goods to the American South. Sanford instructed them to keep a close watch on all shipments of weapons and war materials. He also employed special agents to keep him informed of Southern arms orders. He also took the initiative to inspect a Prussian factory which had filled a Confederate arms order months before. Sanford was enthusiastic and all the more delighted when he realized he could outbid Confederate agents in order to block or seriously delay their shipments, in this way undermining months of Southern planning and preparation. In this, Sanford succeeded at preventing shipments from leaving both Liège and Verviers. Even when supplies such as cloth were deemed too shoddy and expensive to be worth outbidding Confederate buyers, Sanford nonetheless insisted on their purchase. And in one case, when one of his agents insubordinately refused to buy what he considered to be worthless junk bound for the South, Sanford instructed his network of agents to watch for the shipment and to make every effort to stop it in any way they could. If they could not, they were to give immediate notification so that the ship may be intercepted before reaching the South. With respect to arms shipments, Sanford was given enormous authority to stymie Confederate contracts. Sanford received his credit line for purchases directly from the United States War Department. Although he missed out on the cloth shipment in his next operation, Sanford managed to buy an entire shipment of guns bound for the Confederacy, the whole contract for some $60,000. He wrote in his report, "I hope they will be effective in destroying the rebels for whom they were intended." He also bought up all the potash available in Europe and chartered a steamer for its delivery, severely curtailing Confederate supplies of gunpowder. To Sanford, the European press was also a valuable ally in undercutting Southern aid from Europe. Sanford reasoned that if European public opinion could be turned against the Confederacy, then supplies and financial support would likewise run dry. In the winter of 1861-1862, Sanford sought to encourage a pro-Union media initiative through the purchase and strategic dissemination of subscriptions of the London News and American, decidedly pro-Northern newspapers. He also paid the editor of the Independent Belge 6,000 francs to publish regular articles that supported the Northern cause.